The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled A Bridge Between Two Worlds, The Life and Times of the Rosh, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilu Nishmos, Mordechai ben Reuven Olav HaShalom, Mr. Martin Walder, Blessed Memory, and Ethel Bas Avram Olav HaShalom, Mrs. Ethel Maller, of Blessed Memory.
Over these past few years, we've described what would seem to be two diverse Jewish cultures. The first was the culture of Spanish Jewry. These were Jews who were by and large a part of the greater Christian or Muslim Spanish culture. Jews in Spain were noted physicians, mathematicians, surveyors, administrators, financiers, translators, and diplomatic emissaries, to name just a few of the many positions the Jews held. Although they were all nominally Orthodox, they would not necessarily all be described as being paragons of virtue. Ramosha of Kusi, the famed Balei Tosfos, the author of the Sefer Mrs. Godel, the Smag, was also a gifted orator. And he preached throughout Provence and Spain in the years 1235 and 1236, encouraging those that had become less observant to make a new commitment to follow the Torah. He described in his Sefer HaMitzvos how many of the populace had already become lax in their observance of mitzvahs, especially tefillin, tzitzis, and mezuzah. This laxity was common not only in Spain, but in Provence as well. When he came to Spain in the year 1236, he encountered an even lower level of commitment to Judaism. Intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews had already become commonplace. Because of his preaching, he had made a definite impression upon the people. But we can only guess what the situation was after he left. The Sefer Seder HaDoros, describing the riots in Spain in the year 1191, stated, quote, "We have a tradition that Jewish men at that time would take non-Jewish women in their homes. These women became pregnant and gave birth. The offspring of that union were non-Jews who eventually killed their fathers or converted them." End quote. Although Spain produced noteworthy giants of Torah and piety, on the whole, the stress of Spanish Jewish culture was to create a Jew who was well-balanced in both Jewish and non-Jewish learning. Spanish Jews put stress upon the knowledge of scripture, grammar, and poetry. Great emphasis, it would seem, was also placed upon gaining expertise in the sciences and philosophy. Except for the very gifted, achieving expertise in the entire Talmud was not the goal of their educational system. History has borne out, however, that only the study of the Talmud and its attendant literature can impart the moral courage to withstand the pressure of acculturation and assimilation. In addition, as we've already discussed in the previous lecture, the uncritical study of Greek philosophy often caused a crisis of belief. It was no wonder, then, that the shocking mass conversion of Spanish Jewry from the end of the 14th century to the end of the 15th century was attributed by contemporaneous writers to be the product of the already compromised belief and lax commitment of Spanish Jewry, which was caused, in their opinion, by the failings of their educational system. Contrast that culture with that of Ashkenazic Jewry. This culture produced Talmudic scholars that, in the words of Ramosha of Kusi, quote, "would only take off their shoes on Friday night. This is because they studied all the nights of the week and only slept for a short time while wearing their clothes," end quote. Describing that culture of Bezalel, the brother of the Maral of Prague, in his work Sefer Etz Chaim, stated, and I quote, "Our holy father saw, especially the Hasidei Ashkenaz, you know, the pious of Germany, to only attract their children to the study of Talmud, to accustom them and initiate them to this holy work. For in it lies wisdom and fear of God all in one place. It is a true bread and sustenance and affords us the protection to live amongst the Gentiles," end quote. At the beginning of the 14th century, Providence shined his face upon Spain, especially Castile, an area unlike Aragon and Catalonia that did not have a Talmudic scholar of historic note. In their midst, since Meir Halevi, the author of the Yad Ramah, who died in 1244, and Rabbeinu Yonah, who died in 1263. It was at that time that Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, one of the greatest Talmudic scholars of the Middle Ages, and the primary disciple of Meir Rothenberg, settled in Toledo. With Rabbeinu Osher, or the Rosh as he's commonly known, the culture of Ashkenazic Jewry became newly transplanted on Spanish soil, invigorating a declining culture and producing disciples and literature that profoundly affects us to this day. His story is the subject of tonight's lecture. The Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher, came from a prestigious rabbinic family. As we note in paragraph A of page 1, the epitaph on the tombstone of Rabbi Yehuda, the Rosh's son, reads, this is interesting, "I'm standing here as a sign," this is the beginning of the epitaph, "a memorial that beneath me is buried the body of Rabbi Yehuda ben HaRosh," this is Rabbeinu Osher, "ben Rabbi Yechiel, ben Rabbi Uri, ben Rabbi El Yochum, ben Rabbi Yehuda," who was born in Germany. Born, as he really goes on all of them, but particularly says Rabbi Yehuda. It would seem that the Rabbeinu El Yochum mentioned as the, being the great-grandfather of the Rosh was actually the same one as the son-in-law of Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Nosson, the Raivan, who, in the paragraph right below, the Rosh notes was his grandfather. So he was he's a descendant of Rabbeinu Eliezer Bar Nosson through the daughter that married Rabbeinu El Yochum. It also seems that the Rosh's father, Rabbi Yechiel, was a very unusual person. This is what the Sefer Seder Adoros, the name of Sefer HaYuchsin, Rabbeinu Avrom Zakuta, writes about him. There's a fascinating story here. This is paragraph B. Rabbeinu Yechiel, the father of the Rosh, was devoutly pious and holy. He passed away in the intermediate days of Sukkos in the year 5028, 1268. His grandson, Rabbi Yehuda ben HaRosh, testified regarding him in his last will and testament that he laughed while he was in his casket in the presence of the entire community. Not that Rabbi Yehuda was an eyewitness, but this was the story that he was told. This occurred when his friend asked of him to fulfill an oath that was between them, that they split their portion in the world to come. In other words, Rabbeinu Yechiel and this friend had made a pact, rather like Yisachar and Zvulun. In other words, one would be the supporter, one would be the student. The friend came to the casket, and spoke to the body, says, remember the pact that we made. At least according to the story, he then moved his head and laughed. Again, in these stories, it's really hard to know the truth, but one rule of thumb dealing with stories like this is the beautiful story they say about the Chofetz Chaim. There was the Chofetz Chaim, one of the great Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, one of the great figures, great Talmudic scholars and saints of pre-World War II Europe, had students that were accused of espionage. This is in World War I. And the Chofetz Chaim came to be a character witness on their behalf. And the defense attorney presenting the Chofetz Chaim, you have to realize when you have a character witness, you have to know the character of the character witness himself. I'm sure what members of the mafia would graciously heap the greatest praises upon their colleagues. So who is the person who is testifying? And he told a story about the Chofetz Chaim, that he was pickpocketed while he was in Warsaw. And he ran after the pickpocket, knowing, of course, he would never get his goods back. But he didn't want the pickpocket to suffer because of his crime. He ran after him and yelled, says, Ich bin der Meichel, says, I forgive you. So the judge turns to the defense attorney and he says, do you really believe that story? And And the defense attorney replied and says, honestly, says Your Honor, says, I do have my doubts. But one thing can truly be said. Such stories are not told about you or I. And it continues on, the Seder Doros. They say that he came back to his home in his Beis Medrash study hall after his death, just like Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, even after his death, his apparition appeared. The members of this entire family, in other words, Rabbi Yechiel's descendants, are referred to, or his antecedents, are referred to as Kedoshim, sacred ones, because they sanctified God's name throughout all the attempted forced conversions. Similarly, Rabbi Yehuda ben Osher, this is referring to the Yehuda ben Osher II, sanctified God's name in Toledo in the year 5151, 1391. Together with his mother-in-law, wife, and sons, they killed each other. Because this was the mass conversions that happened in Castile and Aragon. The entire family gave, and it continued on, unrelated to this, the entire family gives a tenth of their profits to charity. This is and just the earmarks of that particular family. We find also a fascinating story here about that family in page 2, paragraph C. Rabbi Yehuda ben Arush, in this last will and testament of his, he wanted to impart to his children the traditions of the family. And he wrote that when the mother of Rabbi Yechiel was a widow with three small children, her husband came to her in a dream on the night of Shabbos and commanded her to quickly flee away from the city because God was about to destroy the city. She arose from her sleep trembling and went back to sleep. Immediately her husband came to her again and repeated his command to her. She decided to go outside of the city's entrance at once in the middle of the night together with her children. She entered the house of her Gentile washerwoman who lived but an arrow's throw from the city. At the end of the night, when the Zashmeres HaBoker, literally the watch of the morning, marauders came to the city. They killed many of the residents, looted and pillaged, and finally left. She subsequently returned to her home without mishap. In the next section, section 2, paragraph A, it would seem the Rosh first studied under his brother, Chaim. As the Seder HaDoros quotes remarks about the death of this Reb Chaim, that he was the brother and master of the Rosh. It's quite possible there's the same Yechaim ben Yechiel, whose responsum we quoted in the last lecture in conjunction with Mayor Rothenberg. He was the one, if you recall, who came to the King Rudolf of the Habsburg Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and told him so that if you don't fulfill the conditions, we will not give you the ransom money for Mayor of Rothenburg. And he was very forceful. And he writes a whole response, and evidently he was a recognized scholar of the time. And it would seem, it's quite likely, it is really one and the same person. But the real master, the Rebbe of Rabbeinu Osher was Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. I just quote one quote, and his works are really full of such quotes. This is from the Tshuvas HaRosh. This is from the response. When I was studying the tractate of Mikvoyos in the presence of my master, Rabbi Meir, and I just finished, I said to my master, they were describing a discussion, and he continues on, my master agreed with me. Similarly, Rabbeinu Meir held his star pupil, star disciple. Again, this is in the highest regard, and we see from the top of page 3. This is from one of the tshuvas, one of the responses of Maram of Rothenburg. My master and close friend, Alufim Yudoi, Rabbeinu Osher. And he goes, you asked regarding that which Maimonides wrote, and he signs off, says, Rabbeinu, says, Meir ben Rabbeinu Boruch, a blessed memory. When Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg was imprisoned, it seems that the Rosh took a major part in the negotiations with the king to have him freed. This would explain the following quote from the Seder HaDoros, that we quoted in the last lecture, here in section 3, paragraph A. Maram died in prison because the king had brought false claims against him as a result of a certain incident. He asked a tremendous sum in order to allow his release. The Rav was poor himself, and the king did not want any other Jew to be held as a security for this sum other than Rabbeinu Osher, his disciple. In other words, that he would be held responsible for the entire sum. As an act of compassion for his master, he willfully became his security. As the money was not collected yet, but at that point they transferred Rabbeinu Meir to a much better prison while they were waiting for the entire amount to be paid, which we speculated that that's when he was transferred from the prison in Wasserburg to the prison in Eisenstein. In the middle of all this, Maram died in prison. He was originally imprisoned in Basel, Switzerland in 1286. He was brought, it would seem, to Germany in 1287. It's not clear at the end of 1287 or when in 1287. At that point, of course, the negotiations began. We have a note from 1288 referring to the Jews making a commitment to redeem their rabbi for 20,000 marks.
Rudolph.
In 1291, Rudolph died. And therefore it was impossible to have negotiations because a civil war broke out. So Rabbeinu Meir was stuck in prison and it was impossible even to continue collecting the monies. Rabbeinu Meir died in 1293, 2 years later. But it wasn't until 1298 that the civil war came to an end. And it wasn't until 1307 that Rabbeinu Meir's body was finally released. Rabbeinu Osher fled and sent his son ahead of him to prepare for him a place in Toledo. This is how the Seder HaDoros ends the... Rabbeinu Yehuda ben Arosh, we have the original text of his last will and testament. And the story that he imparted to his children was the reason that my master, my father, the Rosh of blessed memory, left Germany was related to the imprisonment of Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg. When the ruler of Germany had Rabbeinu Meir imprisoned, and the communities of Germany were willing to pay a tremendous sum to have him redeemed, the only guarantor of that amount that the ruler was willing to accept was my master, my father, of blessed memory. Before the collection of the monies were divided amongst the communities, Rav Meir passed away while still in prison. This was the 19th of Iyar, 5053-1293. The ruler falsely libeled my master, my father, of blessed memory, saying that since Rabbeinu Meir died in prison before he was freed, my father was still under obligation, and that he and the communities are still required to pay the money for his release. This already, it would seem, was after things had settled down, after 1298. My father removed himself from the king's presence and went to a different city. Because of his fear of the government, he finally left Germany. In the year 1298, in the midst of a civil war between the two pretenders for the German throne, Albrecht, the son of Rudolf I, this was again the king who originally imprisoned Rabbeinu Meir, and Adolf of Nassau, in the midst of this civil war, a nobleman by the name of Rindfleisch, who claimed the Jews desecrated the host, the wafer which is used for Catholic Mass, headed a mob which violently destroyed over 100 Jewish communities in southern Germany and Austria and took over 100,000 Jewish lives. In the aftermath, a rabbinic assembly was called, it would seem to be in the city of Worms, to deal with the problem of the widows of the martyrs and the issues of inheritance. The Rosh played a leading part, and this we quote on the top of page 4. As we stated before, after the Civil War had been settled and Albrecht became Albrecht I of Germany, he began putting pressure on the Rosh to pay the ransom for Rabbeinu Meir. It would seem this was about the year 1303 or 1304. This is over 10 years after Benu Meir had died, and his body was still lying in the prison of Eisenstein without burial. As we previously mentioned, the rush, it was impossible for him to get the money at that point. The communities were not willing to ransom just the body. It was a terrible, the Jews had gone through terrible suffering. They went through a whole civil war. They had gone through the annihilation of 100 Jewish communities. They were in no position to pay that ransom. As we mentioned in the last lecture, it was only an individual who gave his entire fortune away. Alexander Ziskin, Mrs. Wimpin of Frankfurt, who finally had the body released. It was in 1307, and he died shortly afterwards, was buried next to the Maram Rothenburg in Worms. The rush eventually fled Germany. His first stop was in the region of Savoy in southeast France near the Italian border, as we note here on page 4 in paragraph C. From there he moved on to Montpellier in Provence. He came to Provence while the controversy regarding the study of philosophy was raging. Clearly sympathetic to Abba Mori of Lunel and the forces that wanted to ban the study of philosophy, as a guest and stranger, the rush did not feel comfortable to become involved in this controversy. From there, he went on to Barcelona, Spain, where he met the Rajba of Shlomo Ben Aderes. The meeting of the two giants of that generation is noted on the bottom of page 4 in paragraph E, as well as on the top of page 5 in paragraph F. We'll just quote from the Seder Adoros, the name of the Shalshalos HaKabbalah. On his way, the rush stayed for 8 days in the house of the Rajba, and they learned together. The Rajba wrote to the scholars of Spain that they should treat the rush with respect, for he's a great scholar and deep thinker. From there, the rush came to Toledo and Castile, where he became the chief rabbi. Since the days of Meir Halevi and Rabbeinu Yonah, Castile had never known a man of such stature. This is what the sources say about him. Again, we begin with the Seder Hadoros, in the name of Sefer Matonos and Sefer Shalshalos HaKabbalah. The rush was the great luminary, the crown of the scholars. The Holy Rabbeinu Osher ben Rabbi Chiel came in the year of the expulsion of France from Germany to Toledo near 1306. It seems he came before the actual expulsion, but the expulsion occurred shortly afterwards. He composed many svarim and legal books and legal compositions, which are patterned after Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi's condensation of the Talmud. He added, however, the opinions of the Bali Tosfos, as he wrote in Klal 9, says Din 6. And he continued on, we rely upon his words more than that of the Rambam. This is because the Rambam wrote down his rulings without citing sources, as if it were a work of prophecy. This is what I heard from the great scholars of Castile. And he continues on, he made a version of Tosfos, which is called Tosfos HaRosh, which is in a great part of the Talmud. Actually, we have the Rush's versions of the Tosfos, even though, strictly speaking, is not considered within the school of the Bali Tosfos. But he copied over the Tosfos and wrote his own additions. The Sefer HaYuchsin writes, and this is in paragraph B on page 5, the great Rabbi Rabbeinu Osher of blessed memory came to Toledo to enlighten our eyes, to take us out of darkness, stupidity, and naivete, to light, naivete, to light, wisdom, and discernment. And finally, this is the Tshuva of Betzal Ashkenazi, author Shit Mekubetzis, one of the great scholars of the 16th century. The Rush of blessed memory was the leader of this great diaspora extending from the land of the Slavs until France and Spain. The majority of the diaspora accepted him. Not only did the Rush have the Beis Din, the Jewish court of Toledo, thereby being Toledo's greatest authority, he also founded a yeshiva that attracted gifted scholars from across the world. Here on page 6, first the preface of Seder Lederach, who was a disciple of the Rosh. He came to Toledo and he was accepted there with great honor. He spread Torah in the yeshivas and established many disciples. And very enlightening here, we quote in paragraph B on page 6. This is a responsum regarding the identification of a corpse. And this person who was identified was a former disciple of the Rosh and who had a similar name, Usher. And this is what he writes. From the day he came to his yeshiva, with the exception of Rabbi Usher Bar Sinai, this is this person, there was no one else who came to study here whose name was Usher. He was from the land of Russia, and he came here with a bocher, a young man whose name was Rabbi Yonason. Evidently, they came all the way from Russia. There was another bocher here at the time by the name of Rabbi Ruvain. He was from the land of Bohemia. I mean, one can only guess how long it took them to get from where they were, from Russia to Spain, or from Bohemia to Spain. He was the one who recognized the corpse as being that of Rabbi Usher of Russia. But it just gives you a sense of from where the disciples came. So it wasn't just from Bochrim, from young men of Spain, but it was really his name, evidently, was such that attracted scholars from across the world. Amongst his most distinguished students were his 8 sons, most notably his oldest, Rabbi Yechiel, his 3rd son, Rabbi Yaakov, the author of the Arba Turim, the Tur, and his 4th son, and who was a successor to his position in Toledo, Rav Yehuda. Also, amongst his disciples, was Rabbeinu Yerucham ben Meshulam, author of Meshurim and Toldos Odom V'Chava, and this is the Rabbeinu Yerucham, and Rav Eshtori HaParchi, author of the Kafter V'Ferach, regarding the laws of Eretz Yisrael. Regarding his own personal life, please turn to page 6, on section 6. There seems to be a slight discrepancy of the 2 sources that we quote. The first is in the name of the Sefer HaYuchsin. The Sefer HaYuchsin was written by Avrom Zakuta, who was a prominent figure in Spain at the end of the 15th century. Not only was he a rabbi, he was a historian, and he was also a noted astronomer. As we noted in the first lecture of this season, it was his astronomical tables that led Columbus to his discovery of the New World. There's an amazing story, which I did not tell in that lecture, regarding Avrom Zakuta. According to his astronomical tables, he predicted a lunar eclipse of Avrom Zakuta. And this was in his last journey to the New World. Christopher Columbus found himself in Jamaica. This is the beginning of the 16th century. I think it was 1504. His ship had crashed. He was really all alone on the island with his crew, who's facing mutiny, and the Indians there were very hostile and were not providing him with supplies. So he was facing starvation. Noting that there would be a lunar eclipse that night, he told the chief of the Indians that our God is very angry at you, and because of that, he's taking away the moon. And then there was a lunar eclipse, and they panicked, and they came back to him. He says, "Now what can we do?" He says, "You have to." He told him, "You have to agree to supply us well and treat us well." He says, "We agree." Okay, I'll go back to my God and see what we can do. And you know what? The moon did reappear. But this was a product of those astronomical things that we have. Columbus, which part at least of his original library, and those tables are his own personal copy of those astronomical tables are part of Columbus's library. So the Sefer HaYuchson is a history that this Rav Rom Sakuta wrote. And in that history, he writes, he had wealth as well as seven sons and daughters. However, in the version that we have here, Seder Adoris and Mishal Shalos HaKabbalah, we have a slightly different version here. The Rosh had eight male children, at the top of page 7. The first one was Rabbeinu Yechiel. The Torah quotes him quite often. In other words, he was named after the Rosh's father. He died during the lifetime of his father. The next son was Rabbeinu Shlomo, the pious. He died while still a young man. It could be when he counted 7, maybe this is after the deaths of these children. So, after him was Rabbeinu Yaakov, the author of the Torah. He was impoverished, and he did not want to derive pleasure either from the community or from individuals. You see Torah Orachayim 2:42. We will quote this later. It would seem from a passage in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh that he wrote, there's the Torah, at least Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, in the year, this is 5-100-1340. At least we have a sense of when he wrote the work. The fourth son was Rabbeinu Yehuda. Now, as we're going to point out, this is quite possibly an error. There were two Rabbi Yehuda ben Ushers. One was a son of the Rosh, and one was a great-grandson of the Rosh. The great-grandson of the Rosh was the one who was killed in 1391, you know, in the riots in Toledo. He composed Chukas HaTorah and Chukas HaShamayim, as would seem from Sefer Ma'arik, and I believe that's really referring to the second one, in other words, the one who died later, not this one. And it continues on, after him were Rabbeinu Eliyakim. These are all children of the Rosh. Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbeinu Elazar, Rabbeinu Shimon. All of them were scholars in Toledo and composed legal works and commentaries on the Talmud. They are no longer extant, with the exception of Rabbeinu Yaakov's composition, the Torah. Actually, we also have responsa from Rabbeinu Yehuda, the son of the Rosh. It's called Zichron Yehuda. When the Rosh fled Germany, he sent his son Rabbi Yehuda to prepare the way. The Holy Communion of Toledo appointed him as its head and gave him a fine, steady yearly salary. The Rosh brought over his whole family with him, and he died at a ripe old age. We just quote here, you know, on Numbers 2 and 3, how Rabbeinu Yehuda, his son, the fourth son, quotes the first son, Rabbeinu Yechiel, it would seem to be rulings on Masechta Makos. Evidently he wrote on that tractate, at least. Also, we find in paragraph here 3, there's also in Tshuva Zichron Yehuda, we find, which is Rabbi Yehuda, the son of the Rosh, we find an interesting tshuva, and it reads, please, this is a question, this is the Shaila, please teach me my master, my rabbi, my uncle, Rabbi Yehuda. In the presence of a scholar and a man of discernment as yourself, there is no need to elaborate. Your humble disciple, Usher, the son of your brother, Rabbi Shlomo, of blessed memory. And historians speculate that the other, Rabbi Yehuda, is the son of this Usher. We have just another glimpse into his, into his personal life. Here I just quote from on the bottom of page 7 that it would seem, at least it's not sure if this was in Germany or Spain, that the Rosh himself made money by being a banker, by lending on interest. And I think about the, at least we had this quote before in the Yuchson, that he was a man of wealth. It would seem at least he brought wealth over with him, or at least some wealth he had in Germany. On page 8, this is very touching here. This is from the Sefer Menachem Tzion, which are Hagoyas. These are glosses to the the Shem HaGadolim of this of the Chidah. And he writes, his wife died in Toledo in the year 5087, 1327, on the 28th day of the month of Menachem Av. The Rosh died 70 days after death on the 9th of Marcheshvan. Without a doubt, this is the reason that on their tombstone was engraved, those who were beloved and lived pleasantly together throughout their lives were not parted in death. And there's, and they put on a joint tombstone. And finally, in this section, even though we had quoted before that he had wealth, it seems that that wealth was eventually depleted. And the salary that he was given in the rabbinate in Toledo was not sufficient for all his needs. And he quotes here in paragraph E on page 8, the Sefer Yuchzen, this is in the Seder HaDoros, writes that the Rosh died in Toledo on the 9th of Cheshvan in the year 5088, this is 1327. His son Rabbi Yehuda was appointed to his position. The end of his days, he thought of leaving and settling in Seville. This is Rabbi Yehuda. The entire community got up and agreed to pay him double his existing salary and accept his leadership for the following 10 years. This was close to the end of his life, and he did not receive anything from the inheritance of his father. He couldn't pay off his father's debts, even with the sale of his father's farm, his father's books. In other words, the Rosh evidently ended his lifetime in poverty. The details we don't have. His brothers were reliant upon the support of others, and he advised them to return to live in Germany. It would also seem, as we're going to see, that the brothers did not take that advice. But even though we began with the section from the Sefer Yuchzen that he was a man of wealth, it seems that it was depleted. As we noted before, the Rosh came from Germany. And Germany, in terms of its Jewish culture, was very different than Spain. It's interesting to note, we are going to read from some of the responsa of the Rosh to give you a sense of how his position as the rabbi. And as we'll see, this is the trying to correct what he felt were the ills of society and trying to reestablish rabbinic authority. Here's a sampling from the responsa. This is gives us an inkling to his to his approach to secular studies. Again, this is would be totally atypical of Spanish scholars, even that of the Rashba and those other who were homegrown Spanish scholars, who were not necessarily devoted much time to secular wisdom, but all in all, still dealt with it with tremendous respect. The Rosh's approach was typical, would seem, of that where of his roots in Germany. And we read, the wisdom of philosophy and the wisdom of Torah on page 9, and his legal system do not take the same approach. This is because the wisdom of the Torah was received by Moses by Moshe at Sinai, and the Torah scholar expands upon the Torah based upon the hermeneutical system that was designed for its exposition, and makes legal rulings by extrapolating from one case to another. Even though this system does not follow the established scientific, logical method, we follow according to the received tradition from Sinai. The wisdom of philosophy, the logic, is natural. The founders of this system were great scholars who substantiate everything according to the laws of nature. From the axioms of their science, they deeply perverted the truth, and were forced to deny the Torah of Moshe, for the entire basis of Torah is found not in nature, but rather in the received tradition from Sinai. And it should be noted that in the history of ideas and the questions about received knowledge, revelation, and natural knowledge, that which comes from science, there are various schools of thought. The school of thought of the Rambam and the Christian world, the school of thought of Thomas Aquinas, felt that science, or at least logic, philosophy, and revelation complement each other. Others viewed them as two separate, distinct bodies of knowledge, and it seems that the Rush was of that school. Regarding this, it is stated in Scripture, you should be perfect in your faith with Hashem. This means that even the matter under discussion does not follow the laws of nature. Don't have second thoughts concerning the tradition, rather walk with perfect faith before His presence. Therefore, one cannot bring any proofs from the words, from their words of the philosophers, to make a sign, prediction, deduce principles, or use metaphors with respect to the upright laws of Hashem. Regarding this, Solomon the Wise said, all those who come close will not return. This means to say that all those who originally entered the study of this area of wisdom, this philosophy, will not be able to extricate themselves from it and bring in the wisdom of Torah into their hearts, not be able to draw back from the scientific methodology they were accustomed to, because their heart will always be attracted to it, will not achieve success in truly understanding the wisdom of Torah, the way of life. For their heart will constantly be thinking in terms of science and will attempt to equate these two areas of wisdom, bring proofs from one to the other. This will cause a distortion of the law of the Torah, for they are two opposites that contradict each other and cannot dwell together in one place. Just as a modern-day parallel, one of the great sages, scholars of the 20th century, was Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, known as he was the last Rav, the last chief rabbi of Brest-Litovsk, of Brisk. He's called the Brisker Rav. And he had a small body of students. In his lifetime, he had in Poland, Lithuania, and when he came to Jerusalem, he had an exclusive group of scholars that studied under him, under the Brisker Rav's son, Ribero Soloveitchik, Yeshiver Soloveitchik. The yeshiva grew, and today, he says, it's grown even greater under his son, Avram Yeshua. But I know that the Brisker Rav would not allow a person who had gone to college to become one of his students, because he felt that since he had been what he was indoctrinated in another mode of thinking, he would not be able to fully follow the mode of thinking that was his approach to the Torah. And this is Sefakhumt Demoyach. In other words, that was his opinion. But just interesting, this would be typical of this line of thinking. Of course, there were others who had a different approach, but this is the approach of the Rosh, and it would seem to be, it would be the approach of the Germans, of the Chachmei Ashkenaz of that period. This is really part of the same response, again, just to show, we'll continue on, but again, just to show that Russia's approach not only to science, but to people who would not accept his authority, perhaps because he lacked that knowledge. We continue on page 10. The question there was the interpretation of a document that was written in Arabic that a previous scholar had given one interpretation to, and the Rosh had a different opinion. His opinion was also based on a different translation of the Arabic text that another scholar had made, and it's to that latter scholar that the Rosh is addressing his response. And I read, "The first argument that you wrote, that the only one fit to rule on this issue is someone who has both qualities, a master logician, is it a Baal Svora, and an expert in the true literary Arabic language." As the author of this, the one who was having this dialogue with the Rosh, made a distinction between the common Arabic and literary Arabic. Regarding the first argument, thank God for having blessed me fully with a true logical understanding of the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, blessed memory, the equal of any of the sages of Spain in our day, even though I do not have knowledge of your secular sciences. Thank God for having spared me, for it is abundantly clear that it causes a person to become distanced from the fear of God and his Torah. Regarding my lack of expertise of the true literary Arabic language, I have only you to rely upon. Who is more expert than yourself? For all of your compositions are in Arabic. On the basis of your translation, I build my logical structure. If you contradict the structure, then we will acclaim you to be a master logician, bar none. However, I have not seen either from your first, second, or third correspondence, nor have I heard from your mouth anything that has any logical substance. Speaking about a put-down. Regarding this, those that see or hear, thank God, bear testimony there still remains in our city experts in logic. I mean, referring to himself. That which you wrote regarding the elderly scholar of Yaakov Bar Shushan of blessed memory, that he reached perfection, these two areas of logic and linguistic skills, is not sufficient proof to support his opinion. And this is a classic, the following words. Is there anyone greater than Rashi of blessed memory who enlightened the eyes of the diaspora with his commentaries? Yet his own progeny, Rabbeinu Tam and Ri of blessed memories, disagree with him on numerous occasions and contradict his words. For it is a Torah of truth and we don't flatter any man, even though a person of an earlier generation made an opinion. A person of a later generation, assuming he is himself in the same league of scholarship, of course, has the right to disagree. And it continues on, regarding his expertise in logic and your expertise in linguistics, I quote you the statement of our sages, Yiftach in his generation was the equal of Shmuel. Yiftach b'derek Shmuel b'derek. Yiftach in his generation was the equal of Shmuel in his generation. On your explanation translation have I relied. In addition, the Gaonim have stated from Abaye and Rav and on, the ruling is according to the latter scholar. Therefore, our opinion is preferred. And it continues on, even though I am not worthy of being the disciple of the lowliest disciples of Rav Ashi of blessed memory, who was the final editor of the Talmud, or at least towards its end, you have to listen to me. You cannot disagree with me unless you contradict what I say with logic and clear proofs. Because ultimately, I am the expert, and it is to me that you have to listen. So he was, it gives you a sense, he was a very forceful leader. Not only was he a great scholar, but he felt that he had to make his point. On page 11, just like to end this section of the lecture, on paragraph D, this is a very insightful response. Regarding though, this is what the Rush writes, this is in Klal Dalad, this is 4:22. Regarding what you wrote about the custom in those aforementioned places to appoint only those of the most degraded families to be the Shliach Tzibur, the cantor, the chazan for the congregation, this practice is denigration of the mitzvah. It is sending a message that such a position is not fit for those of prestigious lineage. It is as if it were some profane profession or craft. Heaven forbid that the work of God should be viewed as merely a profession. Rather, it is a crown that adorns the head. From the day I arrived here, I have also protested about the cantors of the land. I have not complained about your cantors whom you make their qualifications solely contingent upon lineage. This is not a correct practice in God's eyes. If the person is of good lineage but evil, what benefit does God have from his lineage? If he is from a non-Jewish family, converts, God bestows his grace upon those who are now close to him that came from a family that is far removed. I have protested, however, concerning those cantors of this land who are employed solely for the purpose of the congregation's own pleasure through a sweet voice. They're not concerned that the cantor may be an incorrigible sinner only if he sings pleasantly. The Holy One, blessed be He, says regarding such people, she has lifted up her voices against me. For that I despise her. Just interesting, the parallel in modern times. when so many of the great chazonim, the gifted cantors, were people who were not in their own personal lives committed to Judaism. And finally, on paragraph E, and again, we've quoted before about the Rosh's opinion of secular knowledge, and he decried would be the culture of Spain. But it's interesting about how it would seem to be regarding the traditions of Spanish Jewry. And this is about referring to a certain bird. The halacha is based on the Gemara in Chulin, that a bird, fowl, is only eaten only al pi maseiros, only according to a tradition, making sure that it's not a bird of prey. In other words, that it's even though they may have other signs as a kosher bird, but still in all, there has to be a tradition that it's not deiros, that it's truly a kosher bird. And he says, you should know that I never ate fowl based upon your tradition, the Spanish tradition, the exact identity of kosher fowl. I rely upon our tradition and the tradition of our forefathers of blessed memory, the sages of Ashkenaz, Germany. The Torah was an inheritance to them from their forefathers from the days of destruction of the temple. Similarly, the tradition of our forefathers, our rabbis of France, is more reliable than the tradition of the members of this land of Spain. So, and it is amazing that despite his vocal criticism of Spanish Jewry, he was considered and accepted as the greatest authority of Spain in his time. In addition to the legalistic work that he wrote, this he's using, as we quoted before, the Rabbeinu Alfasi's condensation of the Talmud as his basis. He added the opinions of the Balei Tosfos, Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg, and other authorities, and the Rosh ruled on virtually every topic that's directly quoted in the Talmud. It's a classic commentary. I mean, it's not a commentary. That would be the Tosfos that he wrote. But it really is a major legal document. In addition, he left us with a well-arranged body of responsive, from which some of which I've quoted, a commentary on the Torah, as well as a popular ethical work called Orchas Chaim, which is studied to this day. In many of the yeshivas, during the month of Elul, prior to the month prior to Rosh Hashanah and extending on to Yom Kippur, a section of that work is read together in unison in the congregation. It's in many of the yeshivas in Lakewood here in the Kolo. After the Rosh's death in the year 1327, his son Rabbi Yehuda became his successor. Like his father, he was a person with an iron will. He had severe adversity in his own life. Here we are on page 12. We begin with a quote which we've quoted before, that when he came to his position, he really had no money. But what's amazing is he had, and we quote on paragraph B, he also suffered from an eye malady, which seems lasted throughout his whole life. I've seen one historian write that the reason that we don't have more responsive from Rabbeinu Yehuda was because of his difficulty that he was impaired, he was sight impaired. Most of what he had studied afterwards, after he developed this problem, was through the personal teachings of his father. This is what the Seder Adoros writes, who would read to him aloud. He would listen then analyze the teachings. Evidently he had a phenomenal memory, a phenomenal mind. But he did have this handicap. He left us with a work of responsa, which was published under the name Zichron Yehuda, the memory of Yehuda. It gives a tremendous insight into the period, and I'd like to share with you a sampling. And he deals with an interesting, the following responsa deal with something which we don't have today. The bote dinim, the courts in Spain, would apply capital punishment. They would kill people. And in various responsa, he's dealing with what right do they have to do so? I mean, according to the Talmud, in order to be a Beis Din, in order to be the Beis Din, a court of law that could apply capital punishment, we need two ingredients. One is A, that they need smicha, as they need to be appointed as a judge from someone who in turn before was a judge, who himself was a judge all the way going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that appointment could only take place in Eretz Yisrael. Because once a person had the appointment, one could perhaps go someplace else. But that appointment could only be in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. The second qualification is that it could only, the lower courts were only allowed to apply the death penalty when the highest court, the Sanhedrin, was in the Lishkas Hagozis, was in its special place. They had what was called the room of hewn stone that was in the temple complex. Once it left there, the whole system fell apart. Even the lower courts were not allowed to apply capital punishment. So therefore, capital punishment came to an end some 40 years before the destruction of the Second Temple. How is it then that a court so much later, and did not have smicha, not smicha in Eretz Yisrael, there's no smicha, and is after the destruction of the temple, how did it apply capital punishment? This is the subject of these responsa. And it says, he writes, it is well known that in our time, after the Sanhedrin was exiled from the chamber of hewn stone, the laws of capital punishment no longer are in force. All the punishments that we now mete out are based upon our need and prerogative to mend the breaches of the generation. This is called Hayroa Shah. In other words, to make it temporary, the Bote Dinim have the right to apply even capital punishment. There's Leuken, this is Roinshin, this is Shalei Al Piatera, and is that they have the right to apply punishments even though they are not the normative prescribed pronouncements of the Torah. Blessed be God, who put into the hearts of the kings of this land to give us the power to the Jews to judge and remove the doers of evil. Without this power, the Jews would not be able to survive in this land. Oh, and this is really survive because they put to death informers. Also, many men of Israel are saved by having their cases brought before Jewish dayanim judges rather than for non-Jewish magistrates. The judgments that we make in capital cases are not all according to the laws of the Torah. They are according to what they feel is needed at the time. There's a fascinating incident. I think many years after his death, the Rav Yehuda ben Arush died in the year 1349. In Castile, I believe approximately from the year 1374, capital punishment was no longer applied. This whole power originally came to an end some 25 years after his death. And the reason it did so, because it was misapplied. Again, it's hard to know the true story. The story as it's brought down to us. And we had discussed in the previous lecture about the civil war that raged in Spain in the mid-1300s. I mean, Pedro the Cruel and his brother Enrique. When Enrique finally killed his brother and took over the throne, his minister of treasury was a person by the name of Joseph Enchon, I believe. Pinchon. Joseph Pinchon. He took over, of course. He became the leading tax farmer. And he displaced all the many Jews who had previously had tremendous position of power under Pedro. He had many enemies. When Enrique finally died, and his son was very young. This Yosef's enemies felt that they had the proper opportunity to get rid of their what they could perceive as their enemy. What was said was that there was some sort of a din Torah, there was some sort of a legal proceeding, it's hard to know. And they felt that this Yosef was a menace to the Jewish community. Since the Spanish kings gave the right of the Dayonim, of the Jewish jurists, to mete out death sentences to informers, but it seems they still needed a case-by-case permission from the king, they came to the king, this young king, the group of Jews, prestigious Jews, and claimed that they had an informer that the courts had condemned to death, and they finally wanted the king's signature on this, the king's, and which he gave them. He didn't know the identity. And with that, they went out and killed this Yosef Pinchas. Once the facts became revealed to the government, not only did he, the king, the government, kill those Jews involved in the murder of Yosef Pinchas, but they took away the rights from the Jews ever again to practice capital punishment. Now let me continue on. An amazing story. But again, it's just hard to know. The sources from which they based upon are not necessarily from the side of those who put this Yosef Pinchas to death. This is really from Yosef Pinchas and his family. So it's really hard to know the exact details. As it's stated, it does not give great honor to the Jewish people. Rav Yehuda ben Arush continues on here, and it says, that which we are allowed to judge capital crimes in our times is based upon two considerations. One, we do it so the Jews should not be judged by non-Jews. Many people are saved by being judged throughout our laws who would have been killed through theirs, which he had mentioned in the previous response. Two, in order to put to death those that would be condemned according to our laws, such as informers in their ilk, would not be condemned according to theirs. Similarly, the power of mending of breaches, Migdor Milsa, Ligdor Peretz, which every generation is required to implement commensurate to the needs of the time, is put by the Torah in the hands of the Beis Din, the Jewish court of law, to use as they see fit according to the needs of the hour in order to mend the breach. The exercise of these judicial powers is dependent upon the type of criminal that we are dealing with. There's a transgressor to whom it is sufficient for the court to issue a warning not to seclude himself with any non-Jewish woman, even in the presence of only one witness, or he'll be handed to the government for corporal punishment. In that time, it just gives you a sense of the government, it was a capital crime for a Jew to have relations with a non-Jewish woman. What they allowed, though, the government allowed the Jewish courts to mete out that sentence. And as a result, the Jewish court was much more lenient. And perhaps this is if a warning would be sufficient, we would just issue a warning. If he accepts the warning of the court and makes a commitment to only stay in the city as long as he feels that he can control himself, in other words, he says, and keeps away from her, otherwise he pledges to leave the city on his own accord, then the Beis Din will leave him to his own recognizance. However, if the Beis Din sees that a warning is not sufficient, it will repeat the crime, and there was, he's taking his life into his hands, because again, if it gets to the government, unless they banish him from the city or the whole county, they should do so. They see that the other measures besides the aforementioned should be implemented to alleviate the sin and danger, let them do so. They should try to protect him from a death sentence as long as it does not become common knowledge he was guilty of immoral relations and the danger is not imminent. Otherwise, the only remedy for the crime is burial in the ground, because if they don't do it, the non-Jew, and they would do it, they would kill him in the most cruel manner by burning at the stake. In another ruling, again, just your sense of what kind of a person he was, seems to me that if God forbid such a thing would have occurred here in Toledo, this is in Shuvin Ayin Test, 79, page 14, that someone for Cordova struck a lethal blow at a Dayan, and those laid wait for him, you know, and he went and he almost killed him. He also destroyed the majesty of his face. I don't know, evidently he must have done a blow to his face in a way that disfigured him. The scholars and elders would agree to pronounce judgment, cut off both of his hands for the two blows which he struck the Dian. He's saying what we would have done in Toledo. This happened not under his jurisdiction in Cordova, but it gives you a sense of the power of the court then. You could read this on your own. This is a fascinating thing on the bottom of page 14. It seems that the elders, the council, in his community, wanted to change the ways that the Beis Din pronounces its rulings. And they really would have one methodology. They would rule according to the Rosh, Rabbi Usher, who had been the previous Rav of Toledo. However, in any instance where there's no clear ruling of the Rosh, they would rule solely upon the ruling of Maimonides of Rambam. So basically to make things easy. Here he argues that it is in the hands of a capable judge to judge the issue on its own merits and to come to whatever conclusion he comes to, and not to be put in a straitjacket and be forced to rule in a way which is not according really to the dictates of the Torah. It was after his plea to the city of Toledo that they decided to renew his contract, was to double his salary, and to give him a 10-year contract. He died shortly afterwards, but because it would seem of the controversy, he was willing at that point to move to Seville. On the top of page 15, this is the end of this response, and he says, over the last 40 years, there have never been so few arguments between the legal authorities as there are now. There's no reason to implement anything like this. Thank God that every time we come together, we unanimously agree as a single opinion. And further on, he says, if God forbid I am the cause of this great pain that you're experiencing, as if this is just a ploy, he says, you really don't want me. Send me away from you and I will leave. He continues on, you are my witness as well as the entire community that from the day you chose me to occupy the seat of my master, my father of blessed memory, that I have not favored any man in judgment. Evidently, there was, you know, it would seem from this it wasn't just a question of having precise rules. There seems to be a complaint about the way he ruled. They just didn't like the way he ruled and wanted to have something which would be dependable. So he says, in the beginning, he says, really, that doesn't follow the guidelines of the Torah. Second of all, there's no need to make any changes because everything is fine. There's no really arguments within our community. And if you have personal, it's really just a way, you don't like the way I rule, well, I'm ready to leave. But he said, but there's no grounds to impugn my integrity, because all that I've done according strictly to what I felt intellectually was the right decision. I've never favored any man. But it would seem, the fact that he made such a statement at the end, would seem that there was it wasn't just a matter of an academic question. They really were not happy with him as the judge. In paragraph G, that he in turn had the greatest respect for the congregation, for the community in Toledo. My prayer to the God of the world is that he pay the holy congregation a fitting reward for their toil, for all the good that they have done for me. As he appreciated it. Yehuda left us with a very rich legacy. Beside his responsum, he left us with his last will and testament. We quoted from it in terms of the historical portions. Here is what this is what he left as a legacy to his children in terms of moral teachings. Hearken unto Yehuda, your father, and make your study of Torah the essential focus of your life. Remember your Creator in your youth while you still have your strength, and accept the yoke of the Torah upon yourselves, that not be removed from your mouths. All of your deeds should be for the sake of heaven, Maintain the good name that you've inherited from your forebears and pass it on to your children. Don't think that expertise in the Torah is an inheritance you received from your forefathers. You don't have to toil to comprehend it. This is not so. If you don't put in the effort, you will not merit to become an expert in it. Continues on, you should also set aside times to study scripture grammatically and with commentary. You should also accustom yourselves to the art and science of delivering sermons. Familiarize yourself with the Midrashim. With this, your reward will be increased, for you will now have the ability to publicly deliver sermons and thereby turn away the people from sin. In other words, he says you should cultivate your speaking ability. Okay. Further on, he says, in the final analysis, you should consider yourselves to be manual workers who are solely employed to serve Hashem. May He be blessed. Regarding marriage, he gives them the advice, you should marry women only from families that are accustomed to living with Torah scholars and whose hearts are embedded with the love of Torah, that will help their husbands to reap the full benefits of their Torah study. Actually, in the original, even though this is, he mentions that they should really choose wives from their own relatives, you know, from the Rush's family, because, you know, that family is one that's dedicated to Torah. In addition, such women are not accustomed to spend excessively on themselves, that would therefore not demand that their husbands supply them with luxuries. It is the pursuit of luxuries that overwhelm and force a person away from the study of Torah. And he finishes, may the merit of the compassionate one and the merit of our forefathers stand by our side and not be removed from our family in Toledo until the time the great and awesome God will reestablish the temple and bring the Redeemer to Zion. And finally, here we have from his tombstone, as we said before, he assumed the position of his father immediately after his death and maintained that position for a period of 21 years. He died on the 17th of Tammuz in 1349. And it would seem there was the bubonic plague, the black plague was going on there, and he and his family died during this period. He himself, it seems, also followed this advice. His first wife, Rabbi Yehuda, was his niece, the daughter of Rabbeinu Yechiel. And his second wife, after she had died, he remarried, took the daughter of his brother, Rabbi Yaakov, the author of the Torah. We just quote here on page 17. As we note, there was another of Yehuda ben Usher who was a great nephew of the previous Rabbi Yehuda ben Usher. We quoted a letter that this Rabbi Yehuda ben Usher, this Rabbi ben Usher, as it would seem, his father wrote a question to his uncle Rabbi Yehuda. This is that Rabbeinu Usher's son, who was a great scholar, originally in the city of Burgos. This is northern Spain. And later on, as we said, these are from, you can look at yourself, these responses are from the Rivosh, Ritz Ben Sheshes, who was the leading rabbi in Spain in the end of the 1300s. And finally, he was in the city of Toledo. He died a martyr's death, this Rabbi Yehuda, during the riots of 1391, as we explained before. And it was seen that this Rabbi Yehuda ben Usher was the author of this Chukah Shamayim that we quoted before, and he was the one who died a martyr's death. The most famous descendant of the Rosh, however, whose impact was in a sense no less than his father's, was the Rosh's son, Rabbi Yaakov. He worked in poverty, suffering, and anonymity. He did not hold any rabbinic position. Yet his influence and his works were the impetus to create a single uniform legal code that would be observed by Jews the world over. The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo is a direct result of Rabbi Yaakov's work, Arbaturim, four rows and patterned totally after it. Mirz Hashem will go over it one day in greater detail, but let's just touch upon briefly the life of Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of the Rosh. It seems, I mean, we find in one of the responsa that he was a study partner, was a student of a brother of his, an older brother, it would seem, who was his teacher. In all probability, this is the Rabbeinu Yechiel, the oldest of the children of the Rosh. He is the only one of his brothers. I mean, he quotes him here in paragraph two. But again, his major teacher was the Rosh, who he always quotes, Adoni Ovi Zal, my master, my father. He was a person who lived in tremendous poverty. As we've quoted before, he asked a question to his father, is he required to extend himself on the meals on Shabbos because he lives on other people's charity. On his epitaph, he says, it's written, a perfect man who sat in a tent of Torah, his whole life was filled with pain. He bore suffering with endearment of God and died with great love. He was brought to rest adjacent to his father, the Rosh Zal, in the graves that he had dug for himself. Behold, his five sons came into a section, two on his right and three on his left. This is all on the tombstone. Evidently, they had died before the tombstone was written, and evidently the tombstone was written shortly after his death, so it seemed that at least many of them, if not all of them, died in his lifetime. In other words, he suffered tremendously. He was a very humble person. And with great humility does describe his work, which is a masterful work. Any student of halacha has to study. A true student, a posek, has to study the Torah. And in his preface, he writes on page 19, because of the period of our diaspora is extended for so long, our strength has waned, our hearts are desolate, our hands are weak, the logic has become faulty, arguments have grown, opinions have increased, and there is no halakhic ruling that does not have divergence of opinion. God and Israel know that I have not authored this work in order to acquire any special status, for I have not done anything that is worthy of conferring upon me such status. I can be compared to a student who studied under his master and wrote down his words in order to become proficient, or to a gleaner who gleans after the reapers have passed, or like someone who collects between the sheaves, one stalk here, one there, between the wheat stalks. In truth, I am only like the gleaners after the first wave of gleaners have gone through the remnants of the harvest. I pray that he who knows all that is secret will help me bring to light all that is concealed and bring me closer to his service. That's beautiful. I quote here, you can look at it as the Hakdoma, the preface to the Sma, one of the great works, the Sefer Miras Einayim, on the Choshen Mishpat. And again, this is about what he had, about the greatness of the work of the Torah, that he virtually brought all the legal rulings of those before him, at least the major authorities, Rambam, Ramban, the Bali Tosfos. This is the Ramah, the Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, Sefer Trumas, many Tshuvas of the Gaonim and others, the Tshuvas and Torah Sabayas of the Rajba, many authorities that the Rosh had admitted, many response of the Rosh. These are all in that work. His message to his children was, you should carefully spend time in order to learn in depth and search through all the pertinent works when you make a ruling that affect the broader community. Do not spend time to needlessly ponder all the difficulties of this subject. Most people who are involved in this preoccupation to ponder the difficulties do so in order to acquire a name for themselves. In every tractate of the Talmud that you study, write down the rulings of the authority, and this should be practical. Also write down the comprehensive principles that govern those halachas that are seemingly complicated. It will serve you as handy reference, and your Torah study will bear fruit. he writes, he was very much against those who stayed in Germany. Germany, as God's help, will in next year's lectures, will point out, they became extremely dangerous. And he writes, if you want to come to this land of Spain, he's writing to a colleague, I'll try to find a suitable community for you in which to settle. You know that it's forbidden for a person to even pass through a place of danger. Most certainly it's forbidden to live in the land of evil decrees, referring to Germany, where a man's life is hanging in the balance day and night. If you have any relatives, please have them also come here. Anyone who removes a soul from there is considered, in my eyes, if he saved a Jewish soul. This was written in the year 1329. Besides his monumental work, really on halacha, on practical, everyday halacha, he wrote a classic, really, it's really in two parts, on Chumash, on the Torah. One is a major commentary, which is based to a great extent on the Ramban's commentary, Nachmanides' commentary, but which he adds to it and enriches. He brings the commentaries from his father and others. It's a wonderful work that was a manuscript and only recently has been really reprinted. I mean, those printings that came some 150, 200 years ago of this work were full of much errors, and the latest printing that in the 1960s came from the original manuscripts, and it was a wonderful work. But he's mostly known on Chumash for his beautiful insights, using gematrias and numerical coincidences. Let me just give you some examples, and with this we'll end this lecture. Again, just how he uses here on paragraph H on page 21, referring how Yosef, how Joseph was thrown into the pit, they went and threw him into the pit, and the pit was empty, didn't have water. It says, says the uses ksiv choser vav. It's missing that final vav. They took him. It's v'yikachuhu. As it says, it's pronounced v'yikachuhu. They took him, but it's spelled as if it would be v'yikachehu. He took him. Why is it spelled differently than it's pronounced? Only one actually took him. The others were behind it, so they were involved. So it's considered it's the plural. However, there was one who actually did it, and that's Shimon, because that was the most antagonistic of the brothers. And that's why he comments when he wanted to separate the brothers. When he in the story of Yosef that he separated the brothers and he claimed that they were spies, he took Shimon aside because he was the most dangerous. Commenting on the verse, V'yavra Anoshim says Midjanim Soichrim, that Midianites who were merchants passed by, they drew Yosef from the pit. And the brothers sold Yosef to the Yishmaelim, or there's a question how to interpret the brothers sold or these Midianites sold. Is it Yosef to the Yishmaelites, to the Arabs, the Ishmaelites, for 20 pieces of silver? Just because it's the time, I just wanted to, just interesting, Be'esrim Kesef, why 20 pieces of silver? He understands the pieces of silver, and there's a controversy because it's not clear in the verse. He understands it to be shkolim, 20 shekels. If it's 20 shekels, and they divided the money amongst themselves, each one of them therefore got the proceeds of the sale. Each one, there were 10 brothers who sold them, each one got 2 shekels, 2 shkolim. The Talmud makes the comment, why were they jealous of Yosef? What triggered it was the Ksoinus Pasim, was the special coat that the father gave them. The Talmud understands, there are various interpretations. The Talmud understands the word Pasim means the palm. It covered the palm. It was a longer cloak than a normal cloak. It was more of an aristocratic cloak. So it added this much material. That material weighed 2 shekels. It's just 2 shekels worth of material. That's why each one got 2 shekels worth of silver. Again, it's just to show this is one of the interpretations. And finally, again, this is just a taste. It's delightful. It's printed in many chumashim. This is from the Baal HaTorim. It says, Haker no, when the story of Yehuda and Tamar, that Yehuda had relations with Tamar, who was his daughter, former daughter-in-law, thinking that she was a prostitute. And as a pledge for the monies, he gave his scepter or fringes. She did not want to publicly embarrass him when later on Yehuda claimed that she didn't know this. He didn't remember the story. Didn't know her face was covered or whatever. Says that he did not know the identity of this woman. But when she became pregnant, he said that she had prostituted herself, and he was going to put her to death. At that point, he said, "Haker no, please recognize," says, "who this belongs to." And he points out the coincidence. This word "haker no" only appears one other time in the Torah. And that's when Yehuda sent that cloak, the special cloak that Yosef had, sent it, drenched it in blood, the slaughtered a goat, drenched it in blood, sent it back to his father, and he said, Haker no, same word, recognizes who the cloak of Yosef was. He used the same words. Now, the same words that Yosef used, the same words that Yehuda used speaking to his father Yaakov, the same word Tomer used when speaking to Yehuda. It's not a coincidence. This was the punishment. Yehuda went through all this degradation as a punishment for what he had done to his father. As the coincidences of the words are not merely coincidences, but they're to point out a lesson. So this, throughout all of the Torah, says these are the kind of gems that the Baal HaTorim left us.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.